Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005. W.S. Merwin was born in New York City in 1927 and grew up in Union City, New Jersey, and in Scranton, Pennsylvania. His father was a Presbyterian minister for whom he began writing hymns at the age of five. He attended Princeton, where he studied writing with John Berryman and R.P. Blackmer, and during a postgraduate year there, he studied Romance languages, an interest that led eventually to his much-admired work as a translator of Latin, Spanish, and French poetry. He then traveled in France and England, settling in Mallorca in 1950 as a tutor to Robert Graves' children. In 1951, he moved to London, where he made his living as a translator for many years. In 1952, his first book of poems won the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award for 1952, selected by W.H. Auden. His prolific writing career now spans five decades, and he is the recipient of many prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize, the Tanning Prize, the Bullingen Prize, and the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize. In the fall of 2004, he was awarded the prestigious Lannan Lifetime Achievement Award. In addition to his more than 15 books of poetry, he has also published many translations, including Dante's Purgatorio and the poems of Osip Mandelstam, numerous plays, and four books of prose, including The Lost Upland, his memoir of life in the south of France. His most recent publications are The Ends of the Earth, a wonderful gathering of essays expressing the breadth of his fascination with the natural world and the explorers who have journeyed through it. In one essay, he writes of his pilgrimage to Mount Athos, the holy monastery in Greece, where old monks hoe monstrous eggplants and okra, where cypresses mark far slopes. And he writes, if you stepped outside the blue doors of the monastery in time, you could see the sun appear at the end of a pink, gold, mother-of-pearl path of mist that blurred the sea. Merwin's selected poems collection, Migration, Selected Poems 1951 to 2001, has just been published by Copper Canyon Press, and we're very glad to be able to offer it for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. Next fall, Copper Canyon will bring out his next book of new poems, Present Company. Merwin has lived on Maui since the mid-70s, and on his 18 acres, he plants palm trees, some of which are rare or extinct, except in captivity. His connection to the land, nature, and his concern for the environment is evident in his writing and his involvement in local issues. In an interview, he recalled childhood hikes in the mountains near his Scranton, Pennsylvania home, and his realization that those mountains represented to him, quote, freedom, beauty, and some sort of exhilaration. But on his 11th birthday, he recalled, he went for a hike with a friend, and when they got to a ridge in the mountain, the whole valley was gone. It had been stripped mined. Even now, more than 60 years later, when he recalls the horror and grief and rage and unspeakable emotions that he felt at that destruction, the complete obliteration of a place that would never be there again. Some of Merwin's most memorable poems deal with this very subject of land and loss, of nature and language, and how they inform each other. Tonight, W.S. Merwin will read from his work. There will not be a Q&A afterwards, but afterwards he will be signing his books in the lobby. It is a great honor to welcome W.S. Merwin to the L.A. Public Library. And please turn off your cell phones.
Thank you, Louise, and it's a great pleasure to be back in this wonderful library. It seems not long ago at all that that I was last here for a celebration of a whole new life, whole new life, phase of life of the library. And I'm happy to be back here again. And I'm glad you've got your parking thing worked out. That's very important because you can't walk here from, you can't walk anywhere in Los Angeles, I understand, without getting arrested. That's the myth. That's the myth outside your city. I trust you know about that. But first time I was in Hollywood, I tried to get arrested that way, but it didn't work. And I want to begin rather differently than ordinarily. A friend, an old friend of mine, not a close friend, but a long friend, Robert Creeley, died a few days ago suddenly, and I mean, to everyone's surprise. And I want to begin with a poem of Robert Creeley's, and then I'll tell you why I chose this one, apart from the fact that I like it. It's called, "For Whatever Reason, I Know a Man," probably because one interrupts conversations all the time with phrases like this. And the poem begins, "As I said to my friend, because I am always talking, John, I said," which was not his name, "the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it? Or else, shall we, and why not, buy a goddamn big car? Drive," he said, "for Christ's sake, look out where you're going." Years ago, back in the 60s, I was reading in Rochester, New York, in the winter, and I've never been in Rochester, New York when it didn't snow in the wintertime. I mean, it wasn't snowing right then. And it was snowing that night like anything, and in the middle of the reading, I saw Robert and his wife, then Bobby, come and sit down in the middle of the auditorium. I was happy to see them, and it turned out that they'd come to drive me in the snowstorm from Rochester to Buffalo. So we got in the car, and by the time the reading was over and everything, and the snow falling, there weren't very many cars around driving, and that was a good thing, as it turned out. We got on the freeway, and everybody was talking Bob Creeley more than anybody, and he was driving along in this tremendous snowstorm with one eye and his hands all over the place. And one of Bob's hands hit the dashboard, and all the lights, and the lights went out. So there we were, driving along on the freeway in the snowstorm with no lights at all. And no cars coming toward us, fortunately, because, they would have lit. But there was enough light in the snow, oddly enough, so you could see something of that. And I thought, well, I guess we haven't driven off yet, because we probably would have hit something, even in the drifts. And Bobby finally reached over and managed to get the lights back on. But it's a complete moment, you know, that you always remember. And I thought of Bob Creeley. I thought of that moment when I thought that he died, and when I heard that he died. And I want to read another poem of somebody else before I read the poems of my own, because it's a poem that I've been thinking about a great deal in the past months. It's a poem by Emily Dickinson's, and I realized, as I read through Emily Dickinson again, the complete Emily Dickinson, a few months ago, back last fall, that I was heretical about Emily Dickinson as I was about a lot of other things, including a lot of other poets. This is not a poem that you will find in any anthology or in any selected poems of Emily Dickinson. For some reason, it's one of a number of my favorite poems of hers that is not included in any of these collections. So I guess I have different tastes than Emily Dickinson from other people, but this seems to me one of the great masterpieces of its kind and of English poetry. And it's number 205, if you want to check me out and read it on your own sometime. But it's a poem I found so haunting that I have not been able to get it out of my mind, not that I want to. A poem of many kinds of mastery. You know, she wrote a lot of poems that are not my favorites at all, that are very kind of, they're kind of sort of dimity poems, you know, about little birds and butterflies and things in there. And I don't, you know, I guess great Emily Dickinson fans love them all. I can't say that I love those particularly. There are many, many poems of hers that I do. But then all of a sudden she'll move into a mode like this one, where she is so upsetting and so troubling. That's probably why some of these poems don't get into the anthologies. Not because, I mean, this. Listen to this poem and see. I mean, the great, incredible mastery that it shows. I should not dare to leave my friend, because if he should die while I was gone, and I too late should reach the heart that wanted me. If I should disappoint the eyes that hunted so to see, and could not bear to shut until they noticed me. If I should stab the patient faith, so sure I'd come, it listening, went to sleep, telling my tardy name. My heart would wish it broke before. Since breaking then, were useless as next morning's sun, where midnight frosts had lain. I want to, because I've resisted selected poems for many years, although there was an earlier one, but I resisted that one too. There are, I guess, practical reasons for having one, but I always thought of a selected poems as a kind of tombstone. I mean, you didn't want to have one of those things. And anyway, a selected poems does run usually in a kind of chronological order, so I want to read them, the poems, relatively chronological way. And I want to begin with a poem from some years back. A poem called The Iceberg. I mean, some years back. I mean, 50 years back. It is not its air, but our own awe that freezes us. Hardest of all to believe that so fearsome a destroyer can be dead with those lights moving in it, with the sea all around it charged with its influence. It seems that only now we realize the depth of the waters, the abyss over which we float among such clouds. And still not understanding the coldness of most elegance, even with so vast and heartless a splendor before us, stare, caught in the magnetism of great silence, thinking, this is the terror that cannot be charted. This is only a little of it. And recall how many mariners watching the sunset have seen these peaks on the horizon and made sail through the darkness for islands that no map had promised, floating blessed in the west. These must dissolve before they can again grow apple trees. That's a sort of bow to the past, and in the book that followed it, there are some poems about poetry right in the middle of it, and I want to read one of them called Air. Naturally it is night. Under the overturned lute with its one string, I am going my way, which has a strange sound. this way the dust, that way the dust. I listen to both sides, but I keep right on. I remember the leaves sitting in judgment, and then winter. I remember the rain with its bundle of roads, the rain taking all its roads, nowhere. Young as I am, old as I am, I forget tomorrow, the blind man. I forget the life among the buried curtains, the buried windows, the eyes in the curtains, the wall growing through the immortelles. I forget silence, the owner of the smile. This must be what I wanted to be doing, walking at night between the two deserts, singing. I want to read a number of animal poems in the time that we have here. And the first of them, and in a way an introduction to them, is a poem called The Animals, which is the first poem in a book called The Lice, published in the late 60s. The Animals. All these years behind windows, with blind crosses sweeping the tables, and myself tracking over empty ground, animals I never saw, I with no voice, remembering names to invent for them. Will any come back? Will one, saying yes, saying, look carefully, yes, we will meet again. I think it's a question that if one asks, one is likely to ask again in the course of one's life. And then a poem called The Child, which comes from that book too. Sometimes it is inconceivable that I should be the age I am. Almost always it is at a dry point in the afternoon. I cannot remember what I am waiting for, and in my astonishment I can hear the blood crawling over the plains, hurrying on to arrive before dark. I try to remember my faults to make sure, one after the other, but it is never satisfactory. The list is never complete. At times night occurs to me so that I think I have been struck from behind. I remain perfectly still, feigning death, listening for the assailant. Perhaps at last I even sleep a little, for later I have moved. I open my eyes. The lantern fish have gone home in darkness. On all sides the silence is unharmed. I remember, but I feel no bruise. Then there are the stories, and after a while I think something else must connect them besides just this me. I regard myself starting the search, turning corners in remembered metropolis. I pass skins withering in gardens that I see now are not familiar, and I have lost even the thread I thought I had. If I could be consistent, even in destitution, the world would be revealed. While I can, I try to repeat what I believe. Creatures, spirits, not this posture. I do not believe in knowledge as we know it, but I forget. This silence, coming at intervals out of the shell of names, it must be all one person, really, coming at different hours for the same thing. If I could learn the word for yes, it could teach me questions. I would see that it was itself every time, and I would remember to say, take it up like a hand, and go with it. This is at last yourself, the child that will lead you. That's the kind of central poem of the Lice, I think. And I want to read two poems that I think are related to it, but I'm not a great authority on some of these things. You know, and I say that probably sounds like what Chamfort called the most decent of all lies, which is false modesty, you know. But one doesn't plan things ahead nearly as much as one thinks one does, you know. You look back and then you see, oh, yeah, well, it worked out all right. So probably I planned it very well, you know. If it worked, you take credit for it. If it doesn't, you try to forget it and say it was a mistake and figure out whose fault it was, but it certainly wasn't yours. But I didn't set out to write The Lice. I didn't know it was going to be called The Lice. I didn't know that those poems were going to be in it in that order or anything of the kind. And when I say I think that's probably the central poem, I think that's the poem that the rest of the book turns around. Let me read two very short poems from The Lice. One of them, they're opposite seasons, and the kind of anime in them are different. Dusk in winter. The sun sets in the cold without friends, without reproaches after all it has done for us. It goes down believing in nothing. When it is gone, I hear the stream running after it. It has brought its flute. It is a long way. How we are spared. At midsummer, before dawn, an orange light returns to the mountains like a great weight, and the small birds cry out and bear it up. After those poems, which I only read one of, about poetry, it was as well to have one called The Unwritten. I think of poetry, by the way, as primarily unwritten, because I think of language beginning in the first place to express something that had never been expressed, that could not be expressed. And there are linguists, and I join them in their belief, who believe that probably the primordial thing that demanded expression was grief. If you've ever heard primal grief, you know that it comes out as one long vowel, and then something has to be done to give that vowel form, and it would be the beginning of consonants and the beginning of language. And as language happens, it's a social, it's owned socially, and it's the beginning of being able to draw someone back from the really destructive urge and force and motion and motive of grief to something that can be shared and that can perhaps lead them back into life again. So one of the things about real grief is you don't want life. You don't want to be in the life that you shared with the lost. The Unwritten. Well, no, I didn't finish what I was saying, because I think of poetry as being the primal art in some ways, because it's related to that primal birth of language itself. That poetry is one of the distinctions between poetry and prose, as I see it, is that prose really is about something. It's about something that can be expressed, and about something that can be known, and about information and things like that. And those things may exist in poetry, but they're not why poetry exists. Poetry exists to say what words can't say. And one turns to poetry for those things, and one returns to them and tries to make it and tries to repeat it and goes back and back and back to it for those same reasons. It's not for what can be conveyed, but for what can't be conveyed in words. So I think of it as primarily and in the beginning unwritten. Inside this pencil crouch words that have never been written, never been spoken, never been taught. They're hiding. They're awake in there, dark in the dark, hearing us, but they won't come out. Not for love, not for time, not for fire. Even when the dark has worn away, they'll still be there, hiding in the air. Multitudes in days to come may walk through them, breathe them, be none the wiser. What script can it be that they won't unroll? In what language? Would I recognize it? Would I be able to follow it, to make out the real names of everything? Maybe there aren't many. It could be that there's only one word, and it's all we need. It's here, in this pencil. Every pencil in the world is like this. And then a poem that I went with Sam Hamill and another friend to Washington in just 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, in the beginning of the Poets Against the War movement. And we had a big reading in Washington. I was in a position where I could do that, so I dedicated to the reading to Laura Bush. I said, without whom it would not have been possible. But then I found that this poem was being read by other poets at similar groups. Of course, we stopped the war, as you know, but a lot of poets around the world got together and said what they felt about this war and about it not happening. And I don't even think of it as a war. I just think of it as an invasion. Awful for everybody involved in it, including the people who are coming home now. Ash. The church in the forest was built of wood. The faithful carved their names by the doors, same names as ours. Soldiers burned it down. The next church where the first had stood was built of wood, with charcoal floors. Names were written in black by the doors, same names as ours. Soldiers burned it down. We have a church where the others stood. It's made of ash. No roof, no doors. Nothing on earth says it's ours. Read a very different poem. It's a little myth. I lived for 3 winters in San Cristobal de las Casas, which is down near the Guatemalan border in the Mayan highlands of Chiapas. Got very cold there on winter nights and very hot in the daytime. And when I lived there, there were 3 Indians for every non-Indian in the town, which was wonderful for me. I loved the place passionately. I mean, I used to sort of pinch myself to try to believe I was alive walking in this amazing place. And many of my American friends were anthropologists, and they were working with the Indians and transcribing most extraordinary stories and dreams and things out of their lives and out of these 5 languages that surrounded San Cristobal. And I thought at one point, I remembered what the movie house was like when I went to see Ulysses, with 5 people in the audience and a little boy going up and down the aisle shouting refrescos after a sign said, you know, no miners are allowed in here because of, you know, It's only for parental guidance and so on. Even back in those days, the little boy with the refrescos didn't care about that. But there were more fleas in the place than there were people watching the movie. That's for certain. And I thought, you know, the fleas never get a word in. Nobody talks about the fleas, or the flies, or the other creatures that are part of our lives. They don't figure in the mythology at all. And this seemed to me strange. So I wrote a poem about it, from the fleas' point of view. And he's called the fleas' carrying words because the men in the mountains they used the wheel. They'd had the wheel for probably a couple thousand years, but they used it for toys. They didn't take it seriously because you can't go up and down those mountains with a wheel. And they carried everything with a tump line on their head, and they regarded themselves as carrying people. That's what I do. I carry things. A flea is carrying a bag of diseases, and he says as he goes, "These I did not make myself. We don't all have the same gifts. Beginning isn't everything. I don't even know who made them. I don't know who'll use them. I don't use them myself. I just do what's in front of me as I'm supposed to. I carry them. Nobody likes me. Nobody wants to change places with me. But I don't mind. I get away, bag and all. Something needs me. Everything needs me. I need myself. And the fire is my father." Different kind of poem altogether, again, about different generations and family relations. Yesterday, my friend says, "I was not a good son, you understand." I say, "Yes, I understand." He says, "I did not go to see my parents very often, you know." And I say, "Yes, I know." "Even when I was living in the same city," he says, "maybe I would go there once a month or maybe even less." I say, "Oh, yes." He says, "The last time I went to see my father," I say, "The last time I saw my father." He says, "The last time I saw my father, he was asking me about my life, how I was making out. And he went into the next room to get something to give me." Oh, I say, feeling again the cold of my father's hand the last time. He says, "And my father turned in the doorway and saw me look at my wristwatch. And he said, 'You know, I would like you to stay and talk with me.' Oh, yes, I say. 'But if you are busy,' he said, 'I don't want you to feel that you have to just because I'm here.' I say nothing. He says, 'My father said, maybe you have important work you are doing, or maybe you should be seeing somebody. I don't want to keep you.' I look out the window. My friend is older than I am. He says, 'And I told my father it was so, and I got up and left him then, you know. Though there was nowhere I had to go and nothing I had to do.'" I think there's one poem that I have to read here because I wasn't born in this city. And it seemed very strange when I first came here. Sometimes it always seems strange because it seems to have changed and I see parts of it that I never saw before. But I was born in New York and lived a good part of my earlier life in Europe. And after I got out of college. And so when I came back, I was really exploring the western part of the country. And Los Angeles was the most exotic place imaginable. Late Wonders. In Los Angeles, the cars are flowing through the white air and the news of bombings. At Universal Studios, you can ride through an avalanche if you have never ridden through an avalanche. With your ticket, you can ride on a trolley before which the Red Sea parts, just the way it did for Moses. You can see Los Angeles destroyed hourly. You can watch the avenue named for somewhere else, the one on which you know you are, crumple and vanish, incandescent, with a terrible cry all around you, rising from the houses and families of everyone you have seen all day, driving, shopping, talking, eating. It's only a movie. It's only a beam of light. I don't know whether they have those shows anymore. I mean, after all, we've had some things that make it probably seem rather bad taste to have shows like that. But I don't know. What's bad taste anyway? Depends on who says it is. I'm going to jump to a poem about a man whom I have admired for years. He was a German. He was born in about the time that Ben Jonson was. Had an ordinary middle-class education and went as a young man, that signed on to a Dutch ship to go on a particular voyage, but instead he was sort of shanghaied and taken out to the Dutch East Indies, where the survival rate of Europeans was very small if you stayed any length of time, or even if you went out there. Very few lived a very long time, but he lived a normal lifespan, long enough to become the first great botanist of the Indies, to write the first encyclopedia of the Indies in Latin, which was then lost at sea, and the first flora of the Indies. He illustrated these two, both of these, with his own paintings. The first flora of the Indies in 6 volumes, which was lost in a fire. And he rewrote it in Dutch. He rewrote both books in Dutch. And to lose his wife and his daughter, and finally to go blind. But his work, his writing is just incredibly beautiful. It's been translated into English by a wonderful man named E.M. Beckman at the University of Massachusetts. In a profession where bickering and jealousy are something like the way they are among ballet dancers, you know. And botanists love to destroy each other's work. They come in and they rename. They take the whole nomenclature and change the whole thing around so that it doesn't have any of those names in it before they had before, and put in a whole new set of them and rearrange everything. But people have left some of Rumphius's names on. His name was Georg Edvard Rumpf, and he Latinized it to Rumphius. He lived first on Java, but finally most of his life on the island of Ambon. And if you're interested there, there's a book of his writings called The Poison Tree in the Library of the Indies that Beckman did, and one wonderful novel by a Dutch woman who lived mostly in the 19th and into the 20th century, whose name was Maria Dermoot, in which he's a very important character. She grew up on the island of Ambon herself. That book is called The 10,000 Things. It's a wonderful novel. I recommend it to you. This is in Rumphius's own voice. The blind seer of Ambon. I always knew that I came from another language. And now, even when I can no longer see, I continue to arrive at words. But the leaves and the shells were already here. And my fingers finding them echo the untold light and depth. I was betrayed into my true calling and denied in my advancement. I may have seemed somewhat strange caring in my own time for living things with no value that we know. Languages wash over them one wave at a time. When the houses fell in the earthquake, I lost my wife and my daughter. It all roared and stood still, falling where they were in the daylight. I named for my wife a flower, as though I could name a flower. My wife dark and luminous and not there. I lost the drawings of the flowers in fire. I lost the studies of the flowers, my first 6 books in the sea. Then I saw that the flowers themselves were gone. They were indeed gone. I saw that my wife was gone. Then I saw that my daughter was gone. Afterward, my eyes themselves were gone. One day I was looking at infinite small creatures on the bright sand. And the next day is this hearing after music. So this is the way I see now. I take a shell in my hand, new to itself and to me. I feel the thinness, the warmth, and the cold. I listen to the water, which is the story welling up. I remember the colors and their lives. Everything takes me by surprise. It is all awake in the darkness. I want to jump to a book called The Vixen, which was published in the late 90s. I mean, 96, I think it was. I want to read one poem from it. It's the poem that's addressed to the vixen. She runs all the way through the book in one way or another. All the poems in that book are in the same part of the world where I found a ruined farmhouse when I was just over 20, down in a part of France that was pretty well unknown then. I mean, French people they knew places around it, but they didn't know it. And it's become, unfortunately, known since then. And a lot has changed. I lived in a farm village where everybody farmed and had animals. Now there are no animals, nobody farms. And it's still beautiful, but it's not the same. But that world is gone. And the vixen was... Anyway, never mind. The vixen is not a symbol. The vixen is she's a symbol later on if you want to make her one, but it doesn't matter to her. She's a female fox, and the fox, all animals are sacred. The fox has a particular kind of sacredness, which I suppose has been contributed by the fact that they've been our adversaries for so long. I mean, they want to eat the chickens that we want to eat, and that's terrible. I mean, it makes them killers, you see. And somebody said to me, well, cruelty exists in the animal world. I mean, look at the fox. It'll get into a hen run and kill 50 chickens. And I said, who made the hen run? I mean, the fox never found a hen run before, and it knows what to do to one chicken. But when there are 50 chickens, I think, well, might as well do it. You know. Vixen. Comet of stillness, princess of what is over, high note held without trembling, without voice, without sound, aura of complete darkness, keeper of the kept secrets, of the destroyed stories, the escaped dreams, the sentences never caught in words, warden of where the river went, touch of its surface, sibyl of the extinguished, window onto the hidden place and the other time. At the foot of the wall by the road, patient without waiting, in the full moonlight of autumn at the hour when I was born, you no longer go out like a flame at the sight of me. You are still warmer than the moonlight gleaming on you. Even now you are unharmed, even now perfect, as you have always been. Now, when your light paws are running on the breathless night, on the bridge with one end, I remember you. When I have heard you, the soles of my feet have made answer. When I have seen you, I have waked and slipped from the calendars, from the creeds of difference and the contradictions that were my life, and all the crumbling fabrications as long as it lasted, until something that we were had ended. When you are no longer anything, let me catch sight of you again going over the wall. And before the garden is extinct and the woods are figures guttering on a screen, let my words find their own places in the silence after the animals. Getting anxious about time. I want to read a different kind of poem altogether called Waves in August. There is a war in the distance, with the distance growing smaller. The field glasses lying at hand are for keeping it far away. I thought I was getting better about that returning childish wish to be living somewhere else that I knew was impossible. And now I find myself wishing to be here, to be alive here. It is impossible enough to still be the wish of a child. In youth, I hid a boat under the bushes beside the water, knowing I would want it later, and come back and would find it there. Someone else took it and left me instead the sound of the water with its whisper of vertigo, terror, reassurance, an old, old sadness. It would seem we knew enough always about parting, but we have to go on learning as long as there is anything. Home Tundra. It may be that the hour is snow, seeming never to settle, not even to be cold now, slipping away from underneath into the past from which no sounds follow. What I hear is the dogs breathing ahead of me in the shadow. Two of them have already gone far on into the dark of closed pages, out of sight and hearing. Two of them are old already. One cannot hear, one cannot see. Even in sleep they are running, drawing me with them on their way, wrapped in a day I found today. We know where we are because we are together, here together, leaving no footprints in the hour. Whatever the diaries say, nobody ever found the pole. At the end of Migration, there are a few poems of the book that's coming out in September. One of them is a poem called Word to the Words. They're all addressed to something, or somebody, or some impossible entity. And I want to go from one of them into the poems that I'm going to end with, which are more recent than any, to the words. And this was written on September 17th, 2001. And before reading out, I want to make a plea for not calling that day 9/11. It sounds to me like a chain of stores somewhere. It's a demeaning trick of television, I think, to give it a little sort of digital nickname that makes it easy and convenient to say. I think it should be inconvenient to say, and it should be said in some way that reminds us that something happened that day. 9/11 is, and it's usually, you know, people do this, you know, with their fingers in the air. I think that's an awful way to treat. We don't do that with Pearl Harbor, and we don't do it with the Battle of Gettysburg or Bunker Hill or anything like that. We give it a name of a place or the Two Towers or whatever it is, but even the date, the full date, September 11th, 2001, but not 9/11. This was on September 17th, 9/17. To the words. When it happens, you are not there. O you beyond numbers, beyond recollection, passed on from breath to breath, given again from day to day, from age to age, charged with knowledge, knowing nothing, indifferent elders, indispensable and sleepless, keepers of our names before ever we came to be called by them. You that were formed to begin with, you that were cried out, you that were spoken to begin with, to say what could not be said. Ancient, precious, and helpless ones, say it. Some others from that collection, I mean the present company collection, I want to read one other one, To Forgetting, which is leads me into some of the last ones that I'm going to read. To Forgetting. Queen of the night, whose reign began before, always before. Mother of how the story goes, song older than singing. You sweep up my footsteps. How did I find my way here? Now there is no way back. You blow my words away without my hearing you. You erase the faces, even of the living. You travel backward wherever you are going, taking the days with you, all of them. Even the ones I imagined were safe forever. Sovereign of terrible freedom, O you without feature and without end, whose face I never see or never remember, how can I love you? Except when you appear for a moment wearing the veils and the long train of memory, disguised as memory, the queen of the day. I want to read several poems that are all, the short poems that are all related. They're small elegies. First one called By Dark. When it is time, I follow the black dog into the darkness that is the mind of day. I can see nothing there but the black dog, the dog I know going ahead of me, not looking back. Oh, it is the black dog I trust now in my turn, after the years when I had all the trust of the black dog, through an age of brightness and through shadow, on into the blindness of the black dog, where the rooms of the dark were already known, and had no fear in them for the black dog, leading me carefully up the blind stairs. Good night. Sleep softly, my old love, my beauty in the dark. Night is a dream we have, as you know, as you know. Night is a dream you know, an old love in the dark around you as you go, without end, as you know. In the night where you go, sleep softly, my old love, without end in the dark, in the love that you know. Into the cloud. What do you have with you now, my small traveler, suddenly on the way and all at once so far? On legs that never were up to the life that you led them and breathing with the shortness breath comes to, my endless company. When you could come to me, you would stay close to me until the day was done. Oh, closest to my breath, if you are able to, please wait a while longer on that side of the cloud. At the bend, I look for you, my curl of sleep, my breathing wave on the night shore, my star in the fog of morning. I think you can always find me. I call to you under my breath. I whisper to you through the hours, all your names, my ear of shadow. I think you can always hear me. I wait for you, my promised day, my time again, my homecoming, my being where you wait for me. I think always of you waiting. I'm going to end with three short poems. First is called Just This. When I think of the patience I have had back in the dark before I remember or knew it was night until the light came all at once at the speed it was born to, with all the time in the world to fly through, not concerned about ever arriving, and then the gathering of the first stars, unhurried in their flowering spaces, and far into the story, the planets cooling slowly in the ages of rain. Then the seas starting to bear memory, the gaze of the first cell at its waking. How did this haste begin? This little time at any time. This reading by lightning, scarcely a word. This nothing, this heaven. The Nomad Flute. You that sang to me once, sing to me now. Let me hear your long lifted note. Survive with me. The star is fading. I can think farther than that, but I forget. Do you hear me? Do you still hear me? Does your air remember you, O breath? Of morning, night song, morning song. I have with me all that I do not know. I have lost none of it. But I know better now than to ask you where you learned that music, where any of it came from. Once there were lions in China. I will listen until the flute stops and the light is old again. Finally, one called To Myself, after which you pretty well have to end. Even when I forget you, I go on looking for you. I believe I would know you. I keep remembering you, sometimes long ago, but then other times I am sure you were here a moment before, and the air is still alive around where you were. And I think then I can recognize you, who are always the same, who pretend to be time, but you are not time, and who speak in the words, but you are not what they say. You who are not lost when I do not find you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.